webinar to sort of look to where we've got to, not so much in the UK, because I think everyone is pretty au fait with the On My Planet Supreme Court decision, but maybe a catch up in terms of other jurisdictions. And then we're going to be looking at some sort of follow-on questions and hot topics for what to look out for over the next year or so here and in other jurisdictions. So on terms of panelists, James and Artie and hopefully Alex are going to be fielding most of the questions tonight. I'm sure most of you are familiar with all of them, but Artie's obviously a partner and head of UK IP disputes at Osborne Clarke. She was co-counsel for On My Planet in the On My Planet proceedings and is currently knee-deep, or perhaps neck-deep, I'm not sure, in the Apple Panoptes litigation. James, likewise, very well known to all of you, I'm sure, is barrister at Blackstone. Recently, actually not that recently now, James appointed Queen's Counsel almost a year ago. He's regularly instructed in some of the largest litigation in the UK and has become something of a feature in the Patents Court in FRAND cases, acting in On My Planet and Conversant, and also in more broad commercial cases such as Canary Wharf and the European Medicines Agency. Alex, if she joins us, hopefully, as you all know, is a partner at Gowling, where she's head of patent litigation and also co-chair of its tech sector. She has been focusing on SEP litigation recently, in particular dealing with early FRAND trial listings, the first UK finding of essentiality. Oh, hi Alex. Sorry, I'm sure this is my fault that we had a bit of a mix-up, but you arrived just in time for my glowing summary of your FRAND experience.
That's very kind, thank you.
Including InterDigital and Nokia, SSH Communications and Sony, and she currently is neck deep in InterDigital Lenovo. So we've got a great panel, lots of experience, and we're going to cover some interesting FRAND related things, past, present, and future. As Suzanne mentioned at the beginning, if you have any questions, perhaps you could type them in the Q&A function as we're going along, or if you'd prefer to ask them in person, we can perhaps field a few at the end and we can unmute you and you can fire away. But without further ado, I think the plan was at the beginning just to cover off a few developments, not so much in the UK, because as we've said, that I think there's been a lot of ink spilt on our planet and where we go from here in the UK. But we were looking to provide a bit of an update and a state of the nation for other jurisdictions. So Artie, I think you were going to take us through what's been going on in Europe, and in particular, as you were saying, in terms of Nokia.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. Thank you, Tess. Yeah, so given the time restraints, I'm just going to talk about one case, and that's the Nokia Daimler litigation in Germany, which concerns component-level licensing, which in itself is a hot topic in SEP and FRAND cases. Like many other SEP cases, there's a wider connected litigation with multiple strands and multiple actions and various different parties. But I'm just going to concentrate on the Düsseldorf case, in which certain questions were referred to the CJEU. And the reason sort of component-level licensing is a contentious subject is that it obviously has an impact on the level of royalties payable. So SEP owners will appreciate that if it's the chip license that is licensed and the chip is sold for, let's say max $20, that the royalty stack available is going to be somewhat limited. There is also a separate argument over the fact that SEP owners can't track or easily verify sales information in relation to chips, whereas in relation to end user products, there is quite often independent third-party analysis of sales. So that's sort of very briefly the SEP holders' complaints. Implementers, on the other hand, prefer component-level licensing, obviously, and fear that end user equipment licensing allows discrimination between licensees, And it allows SEP owners to charge different royalties for the same SEPs and to capture value attributable to licensee innovation as opposed to the SEPs themselves. So unsurprisingly, some polarized opinions there. Although sort of in the Mannheim court, that court refused to refer questions, the Düsseldorf court has decided to do so. I'm not going to go through the questions word for word, but they are pretty wide, and at a very, very general level, effectively the court is being asked whether an implementer can accuse a SEP holder of abusing its dominant position if it refuses to license the component suppliers who are willing to take a license. And then that is kind of split into whether that is affected by the supplier being normally responsible for doing the patent clearance and generally sort of industry norms, which might, you know, which will obviously be the automotive industry in this case. And secondly, whether if the component supplier already has a FRAN license, does the end user need to take a separate license to avoid infringement? And if yes, the implementer does have to take a separate license, what conditions are acceptable for the SEP holder to take into account when deciding whether or not to sue for an injunction in order to avoid abusing its dominant position? So those are the sort of, I guess, component level questions. In addition, the Düsseldorf court has asked questions regarding the interpretation of the Huawei ZTE case, which, as you all know, the Supreme Court interpreted in the UK. But here, the German courts have asked broadly whether if, as a SEP holder, you haven't complied with the pre-litigation steps set out in Huawei and ZTE, you can sort of backfill that by completing those steps after litigation has commenced. So that's a particularly interesting timing question. And as you probably recollect from Unwired Planet, the proceedings were started before the judgment in Huawei and ZTE, but ended up in the court afterwards. So there's this sort of transitional period. And I think they're just trying to get some clarity on what the position is regarding pre and post litigation steps. And then there's some questions about willing licensee, but in the context of potentially in the context of component level licensing and in the context of negotiations, and specifically whether failure to respond to a notice of infringement indicates that the implementer is unwilling and therefore the SEP holder is entitled to pursue injunctive relief, and whether the court can determine whether or not the licensee is unwilling by its counter offer, and whether that analysis needs to be done also by reference to the SEP holder's offer or not, whether they can be sort of looked at independently, I suppose. And then the final situation is if the court can't really determine whether or not the counteroffer is FRAND, does that preclude a finding of unwillingness? If the counteroffer is not evidently unFRAND, can that preclude a finding of unwillingness? So that's a sort of summary of the questions before the CJU. Unsurprisingly, Nokia have appealed, so whether or not it does go ahead remains to be seen. But sadly for us, we can no longer refer questions to the CJU or put in any observations. So we'll have to watch on the sidelines on this one.
Well, I'm sure James will be very interested in what they say about pre-litigation steps and the code of conduct. But for the moment, let's park that one. And perhaps I think you volunteered to talk us through what's been going on in China, James.
Yes. So look, I don't pretend for a moment to be an expert in Chinese law, but from my experience of these global disputes, I can identify essentially three key features of the Chinese approach to FRAND. The first is that the FRAND rates under Chinese patents are set low by international standards, and they're set low for explicit policy reasons by the Chinese courts. The second is that the Chinese courts are now prepared to accept and conduct global FRAND assessments. And the third is that the Chinese courts are prepared to protect their FRAND jurisdiction by way of anti-suit relief. And of those three factors, we've known about the first one for some time. The second and third are really things that have emerged pretty much in the last 6 months. Now, to take those three things briefly in turn, in relation to the FRAND rates, the first big case on FRAND in China was Huawei and InterDigital, decided in Guangdong in 2013 and 2014. In that case, the rate for InterDigital's portfolio was set at 0.019% of average selling price in reliance on a comparable license. There was ultimately a sort of part negotiated outcome at the Chinese Supreme Court in Beijing in 2018, under which a retrial was ordered and then a settlement took place. So ultimately there wasn't the retrial of that case. But we then saw a further example of FRAND rate setting in China in September 2019 with the decision of the Nanjing court in Huawei and Conversant, which set a FRAND rate under Conversant's Chinese portfolio. The court looked at the essentiality and the validity of all of the Chinese patents, which form part of the families which Conversant had pleaded in the UK as being truly essential in a FRAND action. And having done that analysis, the Chinese court found that there was in fact only one true CEP in China essential to 4G, and it set the rate at 0.0018% of average selling price. And what's really important to appreciate about that decision was that the rates weren't set at that level by accident or without any kind of rationale. It was actually quite deliberate that the Nanjing court expressly decided that the sorts of aggregate royalty stacks which had been put forward in the past by Nokia, Ericsson, and the other manufacturers who'd been talking about 8 or 9% were put forward at a time when, to quote the words of the court, the manufacturers of mobile phones were mainly from developed countries and when sales were mainly concentrated in those countries, and that those stacks don't take into account the market development of Chinese mobile phone manufacturers today, to quote. And I emphasize there, the language of developed companies, countries is not mine. I'm quoting from what the Nanjing court said. And on that basis, the court decided that the aggregate should be about 4% for 4G under Chinese CEPs, which is about half of the figure that tends to get used in the West. So it's actually a considered economic and social policy decision based on the position of manufacturers and consumers in China. And the relevance of that is that, just for comparative purposes, if you look at the rates that were set in Unwired Planet for China, even though they were reduced by 50%, the rate payable per family in that case under the Chinese CEPs was at 0.0052, which equates to about three times more than the rate set in Huawei and Conversant, and obviously scaled up to a portfolio level and applied to the kind of volume of manufacture and sales that we're generally talking about in these cases, that difference is a very significant one. So that's the first point about the rates. The second point about global jurisdiction, the Chinese courts have indicated essentially in the last 4 or 6 months that they will exercise jurisdiction to set global FRAND rates in exactly the same way as the UK courts have. At the time of Unwired, the Chinese courts were still only deciding FRAND rates within China. And indeed, the UK Supreme Court in its Unwired decision described the prospect of the Chinese courts exercising a global jurisdiction as no more than speculative in paragraph 104 of their decision. Lots of commentators said in response to that it was inevitable that other jurisdictions would adopt the same approach. And in the case of China, that happened very quickly. Indeed, it now appears that unbeknownst to the parties in Unwired, in June 2020, so that's even before the decision had been handed down in the UK, the court in Wuhan had already accepted a global rate setting case begun by Xiaomi against InterDigital. That gave rise to a big anti-suit battle that I know we're going to be talking about later, so I won't go into that now. And there has then been a case between Oppo and Sharp, in which the Shenzhen Intermediate Court has also accepted a global rate setting case. The relevant factors were that the parties had been negotiating globally, that the place of manufacture and primary sales was China, and that a single determination would be efficient. And those are obviously factors which will be present in a very large number of FRAND cases. And then finally, turning to the third point I mentioned in relation to anti-suit relief, we've seen that the Chinese courts are prepared to grant anti-suit relief to protect the jurisdiction that they're exercising. So in Huawei and Conversant, as I've mentioned, the rate had been set for China. There was an appeal to the Beijing Supreme Court. And in the meantime, it was established that there was infringement in Germany. And the German courts looked at the offer which had been made. And despite the fact that the rate for China was dozens of times higher than the rate that the Nanjing court had set for China, the German court said it was still FRAND and granted an injunction. The Beijing Supreme Court granted an anti-suit injunction preventing the enforcement of the injunction in Germany. And we've then had a whole series of further anti-suit battles in Ericsson and Samsung, InterDigital and Xiaomi, in which there have been effectively some really quite serious standoffs between the Chinese and Indian courts and the Chinese and US courts respectively, which I won't go into in any detail now because I know we're going to come back to it. But in a sense, this was always going to happen once national courts started exercising a global jurisdiction, and at some point something is going to have to give. But that's where we are right now.
Thanks, James. That was a really great summary, I think, of where we are with China. And then I think Alex was going to briefly bring us up to date on what's been going on in the US.
Yes, and I should probably echo James's caveat, which is I'm by no means a US qualified lawyer. So this is very much from the perspective of a UK practitioner and what we're watching out for. So I think one of the things for me that really interested me about the US jurisdiction is that I think, as everyone will know when they're engaged in patent infringement actions, is that the ability to secure injunctive relief in the US has been weakened through recent case law. And so you might have expected a drop off in patent infringement cases, but completely to the contrary, America has been a phenomenally active jurisdiction in SEPFRAND patent infringement cases. And I think, there's plenty to be looking at from TCL Ericsson all the way through, but the one that's exercising the most interest at present is the Ericsson Samsung debate. And that has spawned multiple cases. And it starts really back in December, mid-December of last year, with Ericsson filing a complaint against Samsung seeking determination of FRAND terms for a license to 2G, 3G, 4G and 5G. And that was brought purely as a rate setting case, not a patent infringement case, but has since brought forward patent infringement actions. And in particular, thinking about the injunction issue before the ITC, because the ITC is how you achieve a similar effect to an injunction, really. And so I think when you're looking at America, don't be beguiled by this notion you can't get an injunction, because you can do a lot of, you can achieve a lot of the same aims with the ITC actions. And I think the really interesting thing in the Ericsson and Samsung case is its interplay, as James hinted at just a moment ago, with anti-suit actions from the Chinese courts, where the US court granted what they call an anti-interference order. And what that was to do was to protect the case going forward in America, because in China, there had been an anti-suit injunction in relation to this case. And one of the things I thought was a very novel development from the US jurisprudence, one I think it bears greater scrutiny, is that when the Chinese courts grant an anti-suit injunction, they tend to put a financial penalty on any breach of the same on a daily basis. And those sums can be quite hefty and mount on a daily basis. And to date, none of the other courts have been willing to do a similar thing, being very much of the view that you have an injunction And until you've proven breach, there's no damage, and therefore you don't need to think about a quantification or a penalty. And in this one, Judge Gilstrat, speaking out of Eastern District, Texas, did order an indemnification. So to the extent the Chinese court sought to impose its penalty, the US court was making an order that the parties would indemnify back. So basically neutering the financial damage. And so in terms of watching what's happening in America, I will be keeping a very focused eye on that Ericsson-Samsung debate through the ITC, through the Eastern District of Texas on the rate setting, and in the responsive Sherman Act. So their antitrust cases for alleged breach of RAN, breach of contract.
Thanks, Alex. That's certainly one to watch. I mean, perhaps now we've gone through that, we can pivot a little bit to the domestic framework. So obviously we had the Supreme Court decision in On Our Planet last year, whereby the Supreme Court confirmed that the UK can settle the terms of a global friend license and injunct an infringing implementer, I should say, who isn't going to take it. But obviously at the same time, there are many fora who may or may not set the terms, FRAN terms, for their own patents or for patents in a specific region. And I think this issue was going to be canvassed in Conversant, but it obviously settled. I mean, what's your take? What's the English court going to do in terms of how much weight will it give to rates that have been set elsewhere? Or do you think we'll just carry on ploughing our own furrow a bit?
Well, I think it's already said what it's going to do in the NY Planet litigation, where I think that you've got your adjustment mechanisms in there, and the judges, well, Colin, Judge Burse, or as he shortly is, Lord Justice Burse, of course, he said, you know, the court will take account of other judgments, as it takes account of other judgments on infringement, on validity, and parallel patent cases. But I think one of the things we've got to remember is what's in play here. So the first thing that's in play here is patent infringement action. So if you're infringing a valid patent, you ought to be injuncted. And the friend defense is just that, it's a defense where the defendant is given the opportunity to say, no, I don't wish to be injuncted, I'd like to take a license, please. And then that's a matter of interpretation for the court, which is what is the relevant license given these parties, these facts, these circumstances. And the court will take into account all relevant evidence, which will include any submissions anybody wishes to make about rates set in other jurisdictions. So I think this is all about the jurisdiction of the court to interpret a contract. So I don't think there need to be hard and fast rules here, because it will be a matter of the evidence that can be brought forward.
Yeah, that makes sense. I don't know, James or Artie, if you had anything to add on that.
Well, I think, in a sense, one can see from the last 6 months or so is where the exercise of global jurisdiction in FRAN disputes is going to lead, unless something changes, which is a race to sue, anti-suit battles costing a fortune, national courts saying, we'll decide this for the whole world, no, we'll decide this for the whole world, and parties stuck in the middle trying to work out which national court's order they're actually going to obey and which one they're going to breach. And that's really not a very sensible position, in my view. And one way forward that has often been, obviously I have to be careful because I'm in cases in which this is raised, but one way forward that has been identified for the UK is as a sort of global aggregator, which respects the foreign approaches, respects the foreign decisions and plugs them in. I mean, as a jurisdiction, on any view, the UK has comparatively little skin in the geopolitical game, given the size and the nature of our economy. But we do have highly respected independent courts. And we can't seriously suggest that our courts have a greater say in setting rates for India than the Indian courts do, or for Japan than the Japanese courts. But what our courts can do is use their expertise in settling a license that builds together a global license, rather than saying we are going to impose our view on the whole world, whether you like it or not. And yes, there have been suggestions that that is the direction that we're going to go in. It's said that we'll take account of other jurisdictions and so forth. But the devil, of course, lies in the expression take account, because ultimately parties don't, certainly implemented parties, don't much like the idea that you've litigated to a result in India or Japan or China or whatever it may be, and then you come along to the UK and the UK decides that there ought to be a different outcome for that jurisdiction than the Delhi High Court has already decided. So it's essentially a question of how we exercise this new global jurisdiction sensitively in a way that commands the respect of those who are subject to the decisions rather than the opposite, really.
I guess that this is where the comity arguments that were aired in On My Planet could come back into the equation.
I think it probably illustrates that, and I think some of the judges have said this before as well, that maybe the courts are not the best place to be having these disputes, because you don't negotiate country by country by country in a commercial real world setting. You reach an agreement because, frankly, no one's got the time to be doing it country by country. So, you know, probably arbitration, if you can't agree, is a better answer to most of these disputes.
Yeah, I think that's, I certainly agree with that. It seems to be a very cost-effective and sensible way of resolving some of these points. So Arti, I'm going to ask you, I know there's a limit to what you can say because obviously of the litigation you're involved in, but another key question now is relates to sort of timing of the commitment to take the FRAND license and what that, you know, what that commitment must amount to. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on this sort of, you know, willing licensee, willing licensor dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely. So the concept of willing licensee has been around for ages, and it's sort of, it's mentioned in Huawei and ZTE, but it really kind of came to the fore in England through paragraph 54 of Lord Kitchen's judgment in Unwired Planet. And what he, you know, as you'll appreciate when you read particularly the Supreme Court judgment, you know, what the courts are trying to do, and perhaps this leads into the mini debate there we saw with James and Alex, is the court is trying to achieve a balance. It's trying to, you know, look at these competing interests and find a way through that achieves a balance. And what Lord Kitchen says in this paragraph is SEP owners, you know, entitled to an appropriate award, but also implementers have to engage constructively in any FRAND negotiations and, where necessary, agree to submit to the outcome of an appropriate FRAND determination. And it's basically, I think it sort of boils down to, I think it is a timing thing, which I'll sort of come on to, but it's basically, is the SEP owner only obliged to offer a FRAND license to a willing licensee? And that helps us kind of construe the ETSI undertaking and the balancing that it's trying to achieve. So as you all know, certainly all the panelists, and I suspect most of the participants know, the way that FRAND cases are structured in the UK is we have a series of separate technical trials and then the FRAND trial at the end. Although I think in your InterDigital case, the FRAND trial's in the middle with technical trials either side. But what you have is the implementer enforcing the ETSI undertaking to avoid injunctive relief, but you have the SEP owner committing to take whatever the court determines as FRAND, whether that's plugging in the India rates or the China rates or the US rates, that's up for grabs. But at what point does the implementer have to commit? Now, in fact, in Unwired Planet, Huawei did make that commitment. They gave an undertaking to enter into the FRAND license, but it was only after the FRAND terms had been determined. And what SEP owners are trying to avoid is a situation of going through these very expensive technical trials, potentially going through the FRAND trial as well, and at the end being left without either a FRAND license or without any injunctive relief, or that injunctive relief being delayed until after the FRAN trial. So they're being deprived of their natural, normal relief for patent infringement until a long time afterwards. And you'll have seen from the run of cases with TQ Delta and Philips and Asos of implementers deciding to withdraw from the UK market rather than take the FRAN terms. So yeah, as I said, the question is, when should the implementer commit? Or another way of framing it is, when does the implementer become an unwilling licensee and therefore not entitled to enforce the FRAND undertaking? So at present, and I say that very purposely, that issue will first be decided in Optis Apple in July 2021. As previously mentioned, I'm involved in that, and that will be 1 year ahead of the FRAN trial. There is a question over whether that trial will go ahead, and that will be determined next week in an adjourned hearing. If it's not determined in July 2021, I think it will probably next be determined at the Interdigital Lenovo case, because the same claims are being run there. And I understand, and Alex can correct me if I'm wrong, but that it will actually be heard at the FRAND trial as part of, you know, the broad FRAND issues. Query whether it sort of has any practical relevance at that stage, but, you know, which is why in Optis Apple we're saying it needs to be decided early on, but it's one to watch. In terms of how that trial is going to be run, it's a list of 5 days. There's going to be French law evidence, because as we know, the ETSI undertaking is governed by French law, and it's a question of interpreting that contract. There'll also be licensing evidence, and there'll be evidence from economists, because it's, you know, the question is whether it, you know, ultimately the position Optis is taking amounts to abuse of a dominant position. So yeah, as if there weren't enough trials, there's now another trial of which this issue is going to be discussed and considered.
Thanks, Artie. I mean, I guess one thing about other courts in the adopting the same expansive jurisdiction as the UK is, if they follow the UK's path, it will be harder to withdraw from a market and avoid an injunction, presumably. But it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. James, Alex, I don't know if there's anything you wanted to comment on this point, or feel you're able to comment on, perhaps.
It's a little tricky.
Yeah, no, fair enough. So I think the next point we were going to pick up was just to recap on jurisdiction and jurisdictional battles. Alex, I know we've already touched on that a little already, but if there were points you wanted to pick up or anything you wanted to elucidate.
Sure. I mean, in some respects, this point has been overtaken in its purest perspective. So I think everyone will remember that in these set brand cases about a year, 18 months, 24 months ago, one of the first things that everyone would have a fight about is whether the UK courts did in fact have the jurisdiction to hear these cases and to settle licenses with global reach. And the Supreme Court's answered that one quite neatly for all of us in the summer of last year, going, yes. So in its purest form, that question's over. But in its maybe broader form, which is the topics that James and Artie have already alluded to, which is, to what extent does the court have the ability, maybe is a better word, to settle license terms with global reach when one of the parties may be trying to say, well, you should wait for a different court to reach a decision because a similar issue is before a different court. So I think the jurisdiction question is maybe focused on that. There's no debate at all about whether the UK court can, as a matter of its own jurisdiction, settle a license with global scope. It can. That's what the Supreme Court said. The question is, how do you build it?
Yeah. And how do you see these jurisdictional battles?
I suppose the other thing I should say is that jurisdiction, I don't know, maybe if you were alluding to more the anti-suit stuff that's going on, because in my view, that's where...
Yeah, days. Well, quite. That's where the action is at the moment.
Oh, absolutely. So on that one, I think the big development obviously is the Chinese court's decision to go global on ASIs. So, and also to do that on an ex parte basis. So you, any of you, may wake up tomorrow to find that your client has been globally anti-suited in every court of the world without having known it was happening, which is obviously quite a surprise. Also you don't necessarily get served with any orders to that effect. You find out on social media channels, which is also quite a surprise. So I think that's a surprising twist in jurisdiction and jurisdictional battles. But we're seeing a lot of the courts that would be subject to these global ASIs asserting themselves. So you've had anti-suit injunctions out of Delhi, out of various of the German courts, now out of the American courts. And obviously we had in the IPCOM Lenovo debates, I think it was 18 months ago now, the UK courts, French courts also asserting their ASI. And I think we even got up to an AASI at some point out of the UK court. So if I was recommending anything to anybody, it would be to brush up on your anti-suit injunction knowledge.
Yes, I don't know, Alex, if you could just explain for people who perhaps missed it over Christmas what happened in Wuhan. I think it's been termed the Wuhan submarine or something.
Yes, to be Wuhan is apparently now a verb, which obviously, you know, have you been Wuhan? Obviously tied in a lot with other narratives around the pandemic. What happened is the Wuhan court was asked by a party to adopt a rate setting case at a global level. And consequently issued an anti-suit injunction against any court anywhere in the world who might entertain a case that would interfere in the Wuhan court's perspective with its ability to set a global rate. So for example, that might be bringing an infringement with injunction request action somewhere else. There are obvious issues with this because, you know, suing someone for patent infringement for infringing acts done within a jurisdiction should be something one should be able to do unmolested, really, based on basic patent law principles. But this is all complicated by the FRAND element of things. So that's probably as much as I wish to say about that, because otherwise I'll become a partisan.
Well, I'm sure it ruined a few Christmases. So for that, everyone involved has our sympathies. Although I'm not sure anyone's Christmas was that great. So perhaps it wasn't as bad as it otherwise could have been, but it's definitely one to watch. So I suppose another interesting jurisdictional question perhaps is, which has gone slightly under the radar given all the excitement elsewhere, is the Court of Appeals going to look at HEVC, Vestel and Philips in the spring, which is obviously a jurisdictional, where jurisdiction is founded on a competition law complaint. So James, I mean, I know we've sort of discussed before what the role is for competition law in the context of FRAND in the UK, given where we are at the moment. It'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on that.
Sure. Obviously the reason that one of the reasons these debates, these cases can be so interesting is that they exist at the intersection between a number of different areas of law. So you've obviously got IP law because they're concerned with patents. You've obviously got commercial law because the ETSI undertaking is a French law contract and because there are all the jurisdictional issues. And then you've got competition law. And of course, competition law is actually ultimately the reason why the FRAND scheme exists in the first place. We ran Article 102 arguments in Unwired, but they were treated very much as a sort of distinct pigeonhole to be addressed after the main event of the contractual question and the rate setting exercises. It probably emerges most clearly from the Supreme Court decision. And that's very different from the approach of other jurisdictions, particularly Germany, also the Netherlands, to an extent China, which see the antitrust issues as much more sort of baked in to the whole concept of FRAND than we do. that used to be true as well of the USA, although there's a bit of a move away from that now with the Ninth Circuit decision in FTC and Qualcomm. But I think there's definitely scope for the pendulum, as it were, to swing back in the UK. And although Articles 101 and 102 no longer form part of UK law, we of course have their domestic equivalents in the Chapter 1 and 2 prohibitions in the Competition Act 1998. And I think there are parts of the Frand analysis where competition law is particularly poised to be re-injected, as it were. And thinking about this, I thought that there were probably three. The first is behavioural Frand. We've talked about Huawei and ZTE and the Frand dance that's required. Obviously, one of the key questions sent off or set subject to appeal sent off by the Dusseldorf court in the Daimler case is something very close, if not the same, as the willing licensor licensee question in Optus and Apple, i.e. is there an obligation to promise to take the license set by the court before you know what the terms will be? That's explicitly part of the question sent off by the German court. And the answer that comes back on that is bound to have an impact. So competition law will be relevant in that context. And although we're no longer bound to follow decisions of the CJEU, of course, the courts can follow them. And in this case, it will be explicitly a clarification of Huawei and ZTE, which is part of our law. It's retained EU case law. So we've got behavioural Frand. We then got non-discrimination, because as we know, the UK courts have opted for a general approach to non-discrimination. And their answer to the Supreme Court's answer in particular to your more conventional discrimination scenario of you are charging my close competitor company B three times less than you charge me. The answer there, it was competition law. The Supreme Court said at paragraph 124 that that's to be dealt with by competition law. So insofar as you want to run an argument like that, as an implementer, it's most likely to be a 102C competition law argument. And then finally, there's thirdly, there's the perennial topic of patent transfers, obviously with the proliferation of NPEs, with the theories about whether you can derive full value for the largest portfolios and the desire of newer undertakings to equip themselves with SEPs for the Frand fights. We've had an increasing number of transfers of standard essential patents. Those agreements quite frequently contain provisions which, at the very least, warrant a measure of antitrust scrutiny in relation to pricing and the such like. And there's always been concern at the practice of selling SEPs in an attempt to sort of wash them clean of a prior licensing history for ND purposes. And that's something that the Court of Appeal found was arguable in the interim appeal in Unwired in 2016 before Samsung settled. So I think there are lots of angles for competition law to come back in. And I think in a sense it's only right, given that that is the reason why the whole scheme exists in the first place.
Yeah, that's interesting, James. I think and competition law shouldn't give up hope is what you're saying. There's still room at the table. Perfect. So I think we're doing okay for time. So I think there were just a couple more small topics that we were going to cover before we take questions. And I can see, Chris, you've already put a question in, which James will do his best to answer. So I think one point which we were going to cover briefly was confidentiality and other case management issues, because obviously there's a slight peculiarity in these cases. And then, I mean, I'm thinking in particular of, you know, in Unwired Planet, obviously, where, and I'm sure this arises in other cases where, you know, the license terms are very, highly confidential, but we ended up in a situation, or Huawei ended up in a situation where it made an offer or undertaken to take a license, and it didn't actually know what that rate was until effectively, you know, the license was there for it to be signed after the Supreme Court judgment. So obviously pretty unusual situation.
Yes. Maybe let me just briefly address the question that's been put in, and then I'll deal with the case management thing, because I've just worked out how to use the question and answer thing and spotted the question. So the question has been asked by Chris about the UK and Chinese courts and the difference in the stack and what is driving that. I mentioned that obviously there's a conscious decision that the stack should be different for policy reasons, but it's a fair point to note that a significant part of the difference between Unwired and Huawei and Conversant in terms of the result that they get to in the end is how many true sets, in inverted commas, you regard as the denominator in a top-down analysis. And there's a huge amount of debate about that. The lowest figure is the 800 odd for 4G given in Unwired. The intermediate figure is approximately double that given by the Californian District Court in TCL and Ericsson. And the largest figure is the one that was given by Nanjing in Huawei and Conversant, which is over 2,000, but that's specific to China. So that does drive it, and no one's ever really come up with a definitive answer on that question. So it's part policy and part that question about the denominator. So then coming back to these confidentiality and case management questions, obviously it's one of the biggest challenges in these cases is confidentiality. And as Tess knows, in Unwired, we had, I think, 6 separate confidentiality rings with differing requirements, and that made
trying the case. The 6 you knew about, James.
Yes, there were quite. More. Yeah. the 6 I didn't break. It was very difficult to do the advocacy because, of course, one is constantly checking, can I say this, can I not, etc. It makes the process quite difficult. But of course, it's for good reason, because these are highly confidential pieces of information which litigants want to protect. You're trying to strike a balance, but the practical problem comes when you're required to run a case which you can't tell your client about, or to meet a case that you can't tell your client about. And as Tess has already mentioned, in Unwired, we had the situation where we ran the whole non-discrimination argument based on the Samsung license without ever being able to discuss with our client what the implications of success in that argument would actually be, because the terms of the ring meant that we couldn't discuss that. And we did ask a few weeks before trial for permission to share the details, but that application was turned down. And the result is it's a pretty difficult situation to be in, frankly. And the Court of Appeal has addressed these issues recently, of course, in OnePlus and Mitsubishi. They endorse the overall practice of having an externalize only tier, where you first designate and then the designation can be challenged, and whoever has designated then bears the burden of saying that this really should be in the top tier of protection. Insofar as the decision draws any bright lines other than just saying it's all the facts of a particular case, they say in paragraph 39 that an arrangement under which an officer or employee of the receiving party gains no access at all to documents of importance at trial will be exceptionally rare, if indeed it can happen at all. And in paragraph 107, they appear to accept that comparables, which are going to play an important role in the case, ought to be summarized to representatives of the receiving party. So putting those bits together, I think it's probably fair to say that if the Unwired trial were to happen now, there would be a much stronger argument based on those dicta that there has to be at least some controlled access so that the parties can understand the cases that they're respectively running. And I think that's the guidance given in that case will be enough of a basis to sort these issues out in future.
Yeah, it's good to have that further analysis of the situation. I mean, as you say, it's a tightrope, isn't it, for making sure everyone's confidential information is protected, but making sure also that you can take proper instructions from your client as to the running of the case. So just quickly before we wrap up, I know Artie and I have discussed this topic a little bit before, And I wonder if you could get your crystal ball out and tell us a little bit about sort of the way you see all of this going, and in particular, you know, as the Internet of Things becomes, you know, more of a reality, when you get loads and loads of small market entrants coming into the sort of connected space, what we should be watching out for.
Yeah, so when we talk about the way Frand is going to develop, and of course jurisdiction and the kinds of things that we've already been talking about is one thing. I'm always reminded of, I went to a conference about, I don't know, 4 years ago, and I met a guy who's an in-house lawyer for a car company, and he was saying, oh, you know, this Frand stuff, you know, we don't know anything about it. What's it all about? And, you know, we just, not just we don't know about it, we don't have anyone in our company that knows about it. We don't know how to negotiate these licenses. We don't know what the legal issues are. And sort of, you know, he was completely at sea. And I'm just, you know, always think, well, I'm sure you know what it's all about now, because all the interesting, well, not all of it, but a lot of the interesting litigation is in the automotive field. And I think that's something that when you think about 5G connectivity and what that unlocks in terms of IoT, you know, you are going to have very, very different market participants with very, very different skill sets who certainly the commission recognize that this is going to throw up problems, because there's going to be an array of different types of products. I mean, everyone talks about this, you know, intelligent fridge and smart fridges, and they need a bit more guidance. And the concern is that SEP holders have to be more flexible in how they approach licensing, and that there needs to be more transparency and predictability. And those are sort of arguments that we know generally, and that's obviously the downside with arbitration, and actually one of the benefits of having the UK court and other courts set Frand rates is that there is much more transparency and predictability. So the commission's answer to all of this is patent pools. That's what they think is going to save us all and save all these little market entrants. And, you know, whether or not that transpires to be true or not is to be seen. I mean, certainly in relation to connected cars, it has had some effect, but it hasn't really stopped the litigation. But, you know, that's one thing, that's the next thing to watch, I guess.
Yeah, thanks, Elsie. I mean, because at the moment, a lot of what we've been discussing is in the paradigm of, you know, multinational v multinational. So how it plays out in a very different dynamic will be interesting to watch.
And there's also the question of whether SEP holders bother, you know, whether they just say, actually, we're just after, you know, given how difficult it is to get these licenses, you know, do we just go for the top line and forget about everybody else?
There's also the question, and I think Henry Carr raised this himself in one of his last trials, about what about the collecting societies? Does the copyright approach or the music collection societies have a role to play in providing some guidance when you're talking about the much smaller players and collecting some royalty on IP rights?
Yeah, and certainly, I mean, the copyright tribunal is a sort of more cost-effective way, isn't it, of determining rates and things like that. So perhaps as a model, it would serve quite well for smaller players. But I guess, yeah, we'll have to wait and see how all of that plays out. I don't know if anyone has any questions they'd like to ask the panel, or anything they want to type in the box. Otherwise, I'd just like to say thank you to James, Artie, and Alex for their time and their valuable thoughts. And sounds like you're all going to have very busy years. And so good luck with that. Thanks everyone who dialed in. I just wanted to say that the CLA's got a couple of events coming up. There's going to be a seminar soon on the Supreme Court's judgment on the appeals by Visa and MasterCard in the multilateral interchange fee litigation, hopefully with speakers from the legal teams, so watch out for that. And then finally, and slightly tediously, if you could fill out your evaluation forms when you've got a moment, that would be really appreciated. But thanks again, James, Artie, Alex, it's great talking through these points with you, and very grateful for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for organising us all, Tess. You've done a great job and we're very grateful.
Right, right.
Well, right. Not that great because I appear to have forgotten to send you the invitation, but never mind.
I got here. Yes, yes. Online.
Yeah, well, indeed. Yeah, have a great evening, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.